The best line on Eddie's hair that I ever heard came from his dad. Because Eddie, on one occasion, I don't know when it was, but he said, you know, you can't have brains and hair. And Denver said, some people don't have either one. Didn't he? Yeah, I've got about four different ways I get here, and it's just kind of whichever one I choose, and I chose poorly because I got off at Institute and decided to go down to Nitro and cross the bridge and got myself a surprise, had to turn back and go the other way. So it's a good thing I was trying to get here to hear Frank, and I had the very best of intentions, Frank, and it just did not work out. So I don't have a clue what you said, and if I say the same things, oh well, it's still true, I guess. Our lesson, we're going to read beginning at Hebrews chapter 8 and verses 1 through 6. Today we're going to be talking about the better promises of the new covenant. It's a pretty broad topic. Mostly what I had to do today was try to think about the things that didn't have to be said. And certainly there was no lack of things that could be said about the better promises in the new covenant. But I want to read to you from this section of Scripture to begin. Now, the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, wherefore it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve under the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For, see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed to thee in the mount. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry. So nothing got recorded up until then either, right? Okay. Let me try that again. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 6. As we study today, we're going to spend a lot of time in the book of Hebrews, and that was intentional on my part, where it's not going to be exclusively from Hebrews, but we're going to consider a large number of verses, text there, and for this simple reason, first off, that when we think about the book of Hebrews, Brother Neil Lightfoot in his commentary on Hebrews many years ago pointed out the theme of the book of Hebrews, and his judgment was the word better. And I think that that's accurate, and you can make a long list of the things that we read in the book of Hebrews that fall under the category of better, a better covenant, better promises. That's what we're going to be talking about today. Better sacrifice, better hope, on and on and on it goes. A better sanctuary. That's one of the things that we're going to be thinking about today with regard to the distinction between old and new. And when we use the word better, obviously that's a comparison. We're going to be thinking about where we are today in the new covenant, where we stand. Why is that better than anything in the old covenant? Does that mean that it was wrong? Does that mean it was missing something? Does that mean it was inferior? It was only inferior when we compare it to the new covenant. But yes, there certainly is a distinction. We need to understand that. Better, very important word. And we're also going to be talking about, obviously, promises. What makes a promise valuable? The Apostle Peter in 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 and 4 says, according as his divine power hath given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness. By the power of him that calleth to glory and virtue,
And he says in the next verse, whereby are given to us exceeding great and precious promises, that by these you might be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. Peter, by the way, we're not going to talk a lot about his writings today, but in his writings, people point out that the word precious is found describing a number of things. One of those things is the promises. What makes it valuable? What makes a promise precious? It seems to me that two factors have to be in place for the promise to be precious. Those two things are, number one, do we have any expectation of this promise becoming reality? Number two, is there something valuable that's being promised? Sometimes people promise us things that are pretty much worthless because we know their word is worthless. Other times, I always like to tell people, my dad used to make promises that I had some trust in, but I didn't think they were very valuable because he was he was threatening. If you do that again, here's what's going to happen. I believed that promise, but I don't know that it was particularly precious to me. In order to be precious, what we're talking about is God's telling us something. Yeah, we can put some trust in it, and yes, it's something that's going to be what we want. The other thing that I want you to think about today is found in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 28. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 28, this comes right after the very familiar, it's pointed to a man wants to die, and after this the judgment. In that verse he says, so Christ once suffered for us. And he said, being made sin for us, rather, and to them that look for him shall he appear the second time unto salvation. Well, you're talking about standing on the promises today. Christ once was offered for us, and for those he will appear the second time apart from sin for salvation. So says Hebrews chapter 9, verse 28. Seems to me that there's indicated to us in those verses a contrast between the promises that once were and the promises that we have today. Because we're among those, we presume, who are looking for him, eagerly wait for him, says the New King James. We're among those who are looking for him. So we have a promise, a better promise, a precious promise. I want to talk to you today about four things that I believe have an extraordinary promise for us today. They had a promise in the Old Covenant, and I believe they are much more precious today. The same kinds of things, the same category of things, if you want to look at it that way. The first of those being the priesthood. I believe that there is a promise, a priesthood promise in the Old Testament that finds a much greater and higher fulfillment in the New, and there's an even expectation, a promise still today regarding the priesthood. But first off, again, we're not saying that there was a problem with the Old Testament priesthood. We're not saying that this was a curse on mankind. When we think about what Israel was, and when we compare it to pagan nations that didn't have this Old Testament system, this Old Testament law, the priesthood was a wonderful thing. God promised, in fact, in Exodus chapter 19 and verse 6, that in the words there, and you probably remember this phrasing being repeated by the Apostle Peter, and I think he's actually borrowing from Exodus chapter 19 and verse 6, and it's important when you think about Exodus 19 and verse 6, what comes in the next chapter, the Ten Commandments. This is the point when God is preparing them for receiving the Ten Commandments. But he says something that's very interesting here when he says, you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. You remember what Peter wrote about? Remember that? Royal nation. Or a holy nation, rather, or a royal priesthood. Same thing as a kingdom of priests, royal priesthood. What's he saying? Well, obviously, not everybody in Israel was technically a priest. He wasn't promising that. But what he was saying to the nation was, you are going to have this system of representation. And that's what a priest is. It's funny, today, organizations, man-made organizations, kind of have it backwards, don't they? what they call priests, they're saying are God's representatives to you. And they're going to lay down the law to you, and you are going to follow their orders and their directions. Well, that's not what a priest is. They got it backwards. A priest was man's representative to God. A prophet was God's representative to man, and not even a representative, he was a spokesman. But the priest, his job was to make a declaration unto God on behalf of the people, not the other way around. And so what God says to the people is in this sense, in a very general sense, you, all my people, are going to be called into a priesthood of a kind. Not a Levitical priesthood, but a priesthood of the kind where all of you are going to be invited to make a sacrifice. And all the people were. The priest actually was the hands-on operative, but all the people were required to provide the sacrifices that the priests would then offer. And it was a great thing. In fact, you may recall reading about a rebellion in Numbers chapter 16. And one of the things that Moses said when he is chastising those who followed Korah, you know, they were among the Levites, and he said, is it a small thing with you that you have been chosen to do this? No, it was a wonderful opportunity. I don't know if every priest thought of it that way. Because they being men, as we'll think about in just a very short moment, imperfect and flawed men, they're probably like some New Testament priests that I know, otherwise known as Christians, who are dissatisfied with God's order and who are seeking something else and something more. And you wonder if maybe they ought not to read Numbers 16 and verse 9 and ask themselves, is it a small thing that you've been chosen to serve God in this way? Oh, and they were imperfect. You better believe it. They were flawed. Even the high priest, never once was a perfect high priest, was there? Aaron made his mistakes, famously made his mistakes. Eli made some horrific mistakes involving his sons. He restrained them not. Because of that, received a condemnation and prophecy that your house, your family, your sons, this will be taken from you, fulfilled a couple of generations later with David and his removal of a high priest over his offenses. That man was, I believe, a grandson of Eli. No, they were flawed. The best of them were flawed. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 7 makes reference to the actions of the high priest on the Day of Atonement. He says, into the second, that is the most holy place. He went alone once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors. New King James reads the intentional sins, which I think is an overinterpretation of that word, but we don't have time to go into that. I'd prefer we just simply say errors of the people. But notice that he was not there just on their behalf as one of the people. He was there on his own behalf as well. He had to make that offering, that detailed, that humble offering one day a year, the Yom Kippur, not just for them, but for me too. He was in there on his own behalf. He was a flawed high priest. But in that system, the Levitical system, there was a promise of another priesthood and another high priest. Now, as we view it from our perspective, and again, we're not just here to talk about the fulfilled promises of the Old Testament. Presumably, most, if not everybody here, understands that those two thoughts, those two concepts, that is, the priesthood had promise in the New Testament with regard to New Testament priests, also known as Christians, that the Old Testament high priesthood had a promise which was fulfilled in the New Testament high priest, otherwise known as Jesus of Nazareth. But the priesthood today, and particularly the high priesthood today, has its own promise. Well, why is it? The priesthood today, as the Old Testament priesthood, had an expectation. You begin to see this as the Hebrews writer goes on for quite some time on the order of Melchizedek. And it's kind of strange to compare Old and New Testament with regard to Melchizedek. You know, you're used to having Old Testament references in the New Testament, but typically it will be a long and involved discussion in the Old Testament that's briefly mentioned in the New. And it's exactly the opposite here. Because Melchizedek, if you did not have the book of Hebrews, we'd likely just make him a very minor character. He's a guy that shows up in Genesis 14 after Abraham has returned from defeating the kings that have taken Lot captive, and on his way back he meets this guy who's the king of the city of Salem, later known as, and not coincidentally, Jerusalem. That's why he's called the King of Peace. Salem means peace. And he meets him, and Melchizedek blesses him, and he gives him one-tenth of what he has taken in this warfare, and he goes on his way, and we'd likely forget all about Melchizedek until the Hebrews writer starts talking about it. And I think five times he says he is made a priest after the order of Melchizedek with regard to Jesus Christ. Now, what does all that promise for us? Like here in Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 11, he makes the contrast between, as he says, the Levitical priesthood. If perfection could be found in the Levitical priesthood, for by it or under it came the law, what further need would there be to have a high priest after the order of Melchizedek and not after the order of Aaron? Well, the difference is this, and the promise for us is this. And I won't go into all the contrast between the priesthood of Melchizedek and that of Jesus, but it's extraordinary. Like Jesus, he was prophet, priest, and king. Like Jesus, he was not priest because of who his earthly parents were. Like Jesus, his priesthood is continual. But see, the promise of those things is for us. Because each of those Levitical priesthood, all the sons of Aaron who served as priests over the 1,500 years in which there was a legitimate high priest, all those sons of Aaron, they ascended, they made their own mistakes, they were either faithful or unfaithful, not one of them was perfect, then they died, they passed it on to the other, and that was a promise, that priesthood of something that would come, but would come under an entirely different order, and that someone is Jesus Christ. Well, what's the promise for us today? Well, today the promise is the work of priesthood for us at this hour. Because the world, that is the skeptical portion of it, that is that portion that doubts perhaps that there is even a God, or certainly that the Bible is nothing more than a fable. The world, if they acknowledge that Jesus existed at all, that portion of it will say, well, if he was there, he just lived and he died and it's over, and you are following the directions of a man who lived and died 2,000 years ago, and I'm here to tell you that the priesthood of Jesus, that belief in it, demands something entirely different, and that something is that we are counting on a perfect high priest and a living high priest. You probably remember what's stated in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 15 and 16, and it's talking about the priesthood. We have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmity, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Perfect, sinless. When he made the sacrifice, he didn't make it on his own behalf. He made it on everyone else's behalf. Or over in Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 25 and 26. He is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing that he ever liveth to make intercession for them. Then he says this high priest became us. Who's holy, undefiled, or holy and harmless and undefiled, made higher than the heavens, separate from sinners, made higher than the heavens. Now, it's not a priest description in chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. I don't think I have that one on the, if you're looking for that. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 8 and 9 is not a priest description, but I think that it's important to mention anyway, so I am going to mention it. And he says, unto the Son, that is the Son of God, you have loved righteousness and hated iniquity. He says first, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is a scepter of thy kingdom. Then unto the Son, he goes on to say, you have loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore, God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. All of these things that are telling us that today we have a promise of priesthood. Now, again, I started out by saying, I'm not here to run down God's system in the Old Testament. I'm not here to tell you, look at how bad and how corrupt the priesthood was. Yes, it was corrupt at times. It was corrupt because of the corruption of mankind. It wasn't corrupt because of God's plan. I'm not here to tell you that this was inferior to anything that man ever made, or any man-made religion, or any extra Jewish religion around them. I'm here to say that the promise that they were counting on through the priesthood is inferior only to the promise that we have in priesthood today. And that is this, that we have a high priest who is perfect and sinless and who is holy and harmless and undefiled and made separate from sinners, and whoever lives to make intercession for us. Now, as we look at the text of Hebrews chapter 8, and perhaps I should have mentioned this at the very beginning, I wanted to point out that in verse 1, he starts talking about the high priest. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to. And then he starts talking about what the high priest does. He does it a little bit in verse 1. I think that he does it a little bit more clearly a few verses later, down in verse 3, I believe, where he's talking about sacrifices. There is a promise of sacrifice. The sacrifices had a promise in the Old Testament. The sacrifices of the New Testament, the sacrifices that we're counting on, and I'm talking about in particular the sacrifice of Jesus Christ himself, those have promise. Let's make a few observations about the sacrifices that the priests offered. Number one, the sacrifices that were offered under this system were for the Jews only. We can see the contrast right off. Again, from Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 9, we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste of death for every man. Now, I want you to notice, though, as we think about the Old Testament sacrifices, that the purpose seems to have been to forestall the wrath of God. There was what they called atonement. But I'm going to argue that what they called atonement isn't exactly what we're taught in the New Testament that atonement is. Oh, the word's the same. And in many ways, it is much the same. But the idea seems to be that because of sin, God is ready and justified and prepared to destroy. The word atonement's used in places like Exodus chapter 30 and verse 10, where the Day of Atonement is being discussed. Aaron shall make atonement upon the horns of atonement. What is that? It's blood. That's what he's talking about. He shall make atonement upon the horns of it with the blood of the sin offering of atonement. Once in a year shall he make atonement upon it throughout your generations. It is most holy to the Lord. That was the Day of Atonement. But I'm going to give you a couple of illustrations of what I'm talking about. Show you the contrast. For instance, Exodus 32, an incident that we all know pretty well, I think, the golden calf incident. Well, what happened? Well, we know what happened. They disobeyed God. They were doing terrible things in service to this golden calf. Only brief weeks after they've been released from bondage were they doing these things. Now, what God did was send Moses back, and Moses asked that famous question, who's on the Lord's side? And the Levites responded that they were. And at Moses' orders, and evidently Moses acting by God's direction, or at least with God's approval, ordered them to take up the sword against their brethren, and this they did, and the Bible says 3,000 of them died that day. I don't know if it is purposeful or not. I suspect not. But what a great contrast. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but on the day that you first see the law of Moses carried out, have you ever thought about this? 3,000 people died. On the day that the new covenant came into effect, 3,000 men were baptized and were saved from their sins. You suppose that's a coincidence? It seems to me unlikely that it is. But that gives you some idea of what I'm talking about right now. Now, was it about sin and punishment? And is it about obedience and justification in both covenants? Sure it is. Sin still receives the reward that it ought to receive. Righteousness and grace from God is still available. In fact, from what we understand from the New Testament, much more so. So we're not saying, oh, it's all about this, or the New Testament's all about this. But the promise of the sacrifice of the Old Testament, at best, was only able to forestall God's wrath. For instance, 2 Samuel chapter 24. What happened with David following his sin and numbering the people? It's so interesting to read because, you know, you've probably heard the story. And how that this pestilence, plague was going through the land. Unless you read it carefully, you may not know that the plague was being spread by the angel of the Lord, who evidently, in the form of a man, is simply walking through the land, and people are getting sick, and they're dying. And so David goes to Arana, buys his threshing floor, makes a sacrifice, but the wording there sounds as though that sacrifice, God's not just instantly made happy with everybody, but then he says, okay, enough. The angel of the Lord is restrained at that moment. Restrained. As though if God hadn't stepped in, it was going to be more pestilence and death. And that's exactly what it would have been. He's only restraining them. Now, let's think about true purification. All those things I've said, I believe them to be true. And I believe they're a great contrast to true purification. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 1 through 4 is a great place to think about true purification. What does he mean when he gets to the end? He says it's not possible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. Well, he's been talking in verses 1 through 3 about Old Testament sacrifice. The law having the shadow of things that should come and not the very image could not, with those sacrifices that were made year after year, make the comers thereunto perfect. For then would they have not ceased to be offered? There is with the sacrifice a remembrance made of sin. That's the difference. A remembrance made of sin. God's wrath simply being forestalled as opposed to this. Same chapter, verse 22. Let us draw near. The true heart, full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. What a contrast. Do you see the contrast between these two things? The offering of a bull and a goat, at which point God says, I'm pleased with you. You have done what I've asked you to do. Therefore, I will not destroy you at this time. And in the New Testament, here's the sacrifice of Jesus Christ by which the heart is completely cleansed and purified. And it only happened once. Once for all, Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 10, among the places that we consider that. Number three, and I have to hurry. number three, we want to think about the promise of the sanctuary. And that's mentioned here as well. You notice that in verse 2. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched and not man. Now the sanctuary is an Old Testament reference to the holy place. The tabernacle first and later the temple. Some people refer to an auditorium as a sanctuary. Technically that's not really true. And it's probably a confusion of terms. But in the Old Testament, I guess their auditorium, if you can call it that, was called the sanctuary. It was the place where one met with God, not the high place where you were, the high holy of holies, rather. But nonetheless, there was this place, first the tabernacle, later the temple. Now, in 1 Kings chapter 8, you see the kinds of things that were promised. I'm going to the temple now, even though he's referring to the older tabernacle here. The principles are the same. But I wanted to think about a couple of things that you learn from 1 Kings chapter 8, where Solomon gives his dedication speech when they dedicated the temple. He lists seven blessings, petitions that would be answered at the temple. They include things like victory in battle, that God would accept their repentance after they failed, that he would send rain in times of drought, that he would cause the crops to grow and those things weren't going well, even that he would hear petitions of foreigners who would pray there at that place. Things like that. Great petitions. What he's saying is the tabernacle and then here the temple, there is a promise associated with this place. My personal favorite is chapter 8 and verse 29 when he promises, this is the place where my name is. This is the place where my authority rests. And that was an important aspect of it, and I think the Hebrews writer is drawing on it here in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 3 when he says he is a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle. Now, have you ever thought about that phrase, true tabernacle? Well, now he's talking about Jesus. Now, here in verse 29, he's talking about the prayers that would be answered there, and specifically he is talking about praying. He says that thou mayest hearken. That your ear may be inclined. Not eyes. I knew it was, I had the wrong... sense. It's not the ears, it's the eyes. That the eyes may be inclined toward this place day and night, or this house day and night, even toward the place of which thou hast said, my name shall be there, that thou mayest hearken unto the prayers that thy servant shall make unto this place. So that was the promise of the tabernacle or temple in the Old Testament. But in the New, there's another sanctuary, there's another tabernacle, there's another temple. All those things are the same. That's the church. Now, it's interesting, and you may notice in verse 5, as we read, that he's comparing the tabernacle and the church in this important aspect of it, that both of them were built according to a divine pattern. Moses received the blueprint for the tabernacle. David, as he laid out the plans for the temple, incidentally, claimed that he had received those plans from the Holy Spirit, which means one of two things. Number one, that he simply followed the basic blueprint of the tabernacle. He opened up the Bible and read it there. Or number two, God had given him specific instructions. Which one is it? I don't know. All I know is he claimed that the plans for the tabernacle, or for the temple rather, came from the Holy Spirit. And the plans for the building of what the Hebrews writer is calling here the true tabernacle. That's the church. Those were according to a divine pattern too. And that's what Jesus claimed in Matthew 16 and verse 18 when he said, upon this rock I will build my church. That was a divine intention and that was according to a divine blueprint. But perhaps most importantly, when we think about the better promises that are for us today, we need to think about the nature of the difference. And I think that it's best expressed in Hebrews chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, under the heading and the category of the hope of these promises, and what bearing Jesus himself has on those promises. It'll take me a moment to explain this, but I hope that I can make it a little more clear to you, and perhaps cursory reading will indicate. You probably remember the previous verses that he's talked about hope and laying hold on something that's before us. Here, he changes his reference away from what appears to be the cities of refuge to the holy place and the most holy place, and in particular, the Day of Atonement. You see, the high priest on the Day of Atonement would enter one day a year, that day only, the most holy place. And in a sense was entering the very presence of God. And there were people who were waiting for him. Now, we're relying a little bit on rabbinic tradition here, but there are a couple of interesting traditions that they had. One of those is, if you read carefully about the construction of the high priest's garments, there were a number of things that were put on those garments that they tell us basically served as bells. And he jingled when he walked. And the rabbinic tradition was that they would tie a rope around his waist when he went in, because if he happened to drop dead, they couldn't go in and retrieve the body, so they had to have some means to pull him back out. But nobody's watching what he's doing. He has something like 32 specific actions, some of those outside the most holy place within the view of other priests, but many of them in there. He had to create some smoke and obscure the mercy seat or the lid of the ark, and he had to sprinkle oil on the base of it, and then oil was, or blood rather, sprinkled on the base of it, and blood sprinkled toward the mercy seat. And all those things, they were counting on him to do the right thing on their behalf. But they knew he was in there. They had confidence in him. Which hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and that entereth into that within the veil, whither our forerunner hath entered, even Jesus, made an high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now, what's that have to do with your promise today? Well, if I understand New Testament analogy correctly, we are the tabernacle or the temple. We are collectively in the church within the holy place, but we are not within the most holy place. Only our high priest has entered into the very presence of God. What's he doing there today? Do you have some confidence, number one, that he's really there? Number two, do you have some confidence that he ever lives to make intercession for us? Do you have some confidence that God's listening to him? Nobody in the Old Testament had anything like that. To know that our Savior, who was once a man, and as the Hebrews writer stated a few moments ago, we remembered in chapter 4 and verse 15, was tempted in all ways like as we are, to think that a man who walked this earth, a man of flesh and blood, is seated at the right hand of God today and is interceding on our behalf. My friends and brethren, that's got to mean something to you. That's the most holy place, and that's where he is. Number four, I want to think about the better covenant, which he speaks of as well, and he does that. Verse 6, he's the mediator of a better covenant. The Old Testament covenant was relentless. It was. It was the law of sin and death. I think that's why the Hebrews writer writes what he does in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Therefore, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest at any time we should let them slip. For if the word spoken by angels was steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, you know what that means? Sin and death. That's what that is. That's sin and death. It was relentless. Now, his point in chapter 2, verses 1 and 3, is the character of God. Don't think that you can fool God. Don't think that you can persist in disobeying him. Don't think that he's just going to let things slide. That's his point there. How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation, which first began to be spoken unto us by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him? It was relentless. But I'll tell you this much, it was also based on a righteous God and based on his own righteousness. It was. That's why the first thing that you read in the Ten Commandments, chapter 20 doesn't open with the first commandment. Before God does any of that, he establishes who he is and why he has the right to proclaim to mankind what's wrong and right. That's why it says in verse 2, I am the Lord. I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. That's why God, over and over in the book of Leviticus, notably, and then quoted in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, keeps saying, here's my law, you need to obey it in order to be holy. Or as Peter puts it, for as he which hath called you is holy in all, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation. Because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. It was based on his own righteousness. But I want to close today by giving you the contrast as I see it. And for lack of better terminology, I think I'll put down life in the new covenant. But I want you to think about where we are today with regard to promises, where you are with regard to promises, and especially as we think about the contrast with the Old Testament. Here's life in the new covenant. Again, the principles are similar. I'm not arguing that they're not. But when Jeremiah prophesied in the new covenant, and then when the Hebrews writer quotes him in Hebrews chapter 8, verses 10 and 11, it becomes very clear to us that there is a different attitude. I've heard people try to use what's stated here to try to convince us that what's written is relatively unimportant. Now, in verses 10 and 11 of Hebrews chapter 8, he's quoting from Jeremiah chapter 31. He says, this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel and the house of Jacob after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them in their hearts, and they shall be to me a God, and I shall be to them a people. Now, what's he saying? Some people read something like that and say, see here, you think that you need to read and study the Bible. Well, you're getting it out of the page. I've got it in my heart. God has placed his law in my heart. It seems unlikely the Hebrews writer would be writing that it's unimportant what's written, since he was writing it down at that very moment. That's not what he's saying. It's still what's written. But you know, it was possible. Now, I'm not saying that you'd be right with God, but it was possible to live and die under the old covenant and have, I guess, all your neighbors and friends think that you were right with God simply because you didn't visibly violate any of those things. Now again, God didn't approve of that kind of service in the Old Testament, and God's the judge and knows men's hearts. But that was possible to live and die nominally as a faithful Jew under those circumstances, and what he's saying is your very relationship with God, your very heritage as a child of God depends on your first learning. Look at the next verse. For they shall no longer teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. And what he's saying is, under the Old Testament, you were born into the family of God. At some later point, you were to be taught who you were and what you were to do, and you were to be taught how to honor that commitment. And he says, now, in the new covenant, again, he's not saying what's written isn't important. He's saying you need to learn it, and listen to this, you need to love it. receiving a series of onerous or burdensome commands. Life in the new covenant means learning to love the lawgiver and learning to love his law. Not just receiving, loving. I think that's why Paul wrote regarding the fruits of the Spirit, against such there is no law. I think that's why John writes in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 18, there is no fear in love, for perfect love casteth out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. So as we close this lesson today, I want to invite you to heed the commands of God, not out of grudging fear, but because you know they emanate from a perfect and loving lawgiver, because he loves you. Because he wants the best for you. And that he's promised those things. If we have this panorama, a vista of wondrous promises that have been revealed to us today, that no one, the greatest character you ever read about in the Old Testament, had not a fraction of what you and I have. We know who the sacrifice is. We know what his sacrifice, or what his sacrifice was, and that is himself. We know the